You're listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research on Poverty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Dave Chancellor. For today's podcast, I spoke with J. Michael Collins about savings and debt for low-income people. Collins is the director of the Center for Financial Security and an assistant professor in the Department of Consumer Science at UW-Madison. He says there's a lot of interest right now in what you might call the balance sheets, or the savings and debt of low-income people, and in how they use various financial products. So I asked Professor Collins for the basics of what's going on here.
Oftentimes when we worry about low-income people using payday loans and credit products, auto title loans, refund anticipation loans, all these products that are widely seen as being too expensive or predatory in some way, the root cause of it is just not having any net wealth. And so, you know, people need liquidity. They'll find liquidity from friends, family, from whatever they can do, and then they'll seek whatever they can get in the credit market to try to make ends meet.
The challenge here, says Collins, is to get people to have some savings, a rainy day fund for things like a car repair or an unexpected bill or a medical expense. But Collins says that it's important not just to think of these rainy day funds as a protection against the negative stuff in life, but as kind of a social mobility tool. So you could pay for an enrichment activity through school for your kids, or job training for yourself that may pay off in the form of a raise or a better job, things like that. But as you would expect, there are some catches.
The struggle is for a lot of low-income programs, so for example, the food support programs or Medicare or Medicaid, we have policies which limit how much in assets people can have to be eligible. So there are these outright prohibitions from low-income people having any savings, which means they don't have savings accounts, they don't have savings, and then their only alternative is to borrow. So that makes things a little bit worse. And then there's also issues of the way the sort of formal financial sector interacts with low-income people. It's difficult. For example, there oftentimes aren't financial institutions in their neighborhoods. They don't have an experience really working with financial institutions, and nobody in their family does, so they don't have any kind of historic or social network to talk to regarding using those kinds of products.
Collins points out that the terms and conditions on many of the accounts available through traditional banks or credit unions aren't favorable for a lot of low-income people, especially for someone likely to hover near a zero balance at certain times of the month or year. Things like low balance fees or missed payment or bounced check fees can really start to add up. Plus, some folks may be purposefully staying out of the system.
If you're in the legal system in any way, if you have a judgment against you, child support, garnishment, any of those kinds of things, a lot of low-income people just don't want to be in the system in any way. And so that's another hindrance. So all these things sort of conspire to keep people out of the financial mainstream, keep them from having any savings and relying on debt when the time comes that they need some liquidity cushion. And that over time can really start to add up as a share of budget and also limit people's options when, say, for example, they lose a job or can't pay the rent or something like that.
So the big question here is, in the face of all these obstacles, what do you do about all of this? Or how could we change policies and products so that they might better serve low-income people?
Some of this is a policy response. You know, certain states have banned certain kinds of products, or in Wisconsin, we've limited the number of times you can roll over a payday loan, for example. The problem is that those laws don't remove the reason that people are in trouble. You know, they need liquidity, and so people will find liquidity and they'll borrow online, or they'll borrow from their foreman or something else.
Collins says these policy responses deserve a lot more scrutiny in terms of how or whether they work. But much of what Collins and his colleagues have been doing is trying to figure out how do you help people change their behavior and get out of the spiral of borrowing every 2 weeks on a paycheck that's 3 weeks away. Collins says that some of the things you can do are pretty simple.
Things like just education or counseling around how do you understand these products and how can we create a plan to help you start to make forward progress. Some of them are more legal in nature, where you're helping people understand their rights as debtors and their ability to perhaps negotiate with creditors or even find out if the terms are illegal and have debt written off. So that oftentimes is a strategy for some families that are there.
For some of these families, there are legal remedies that you can point them to, but more generally, says Collins, advice has a key role.
In some communities, there are really robust nonprofit organizations that provide counseling and provide coaching and really help people pull their credit report, look at their credit history, correct any errors, and come up with a plan to pay off what debt they have. So I think these are all strategies that are important to think about. But it gets complicated. I mean, for example, one of the biggest items on low-income people's credit reports is student loans, which we have very few options to try to deal with. Another one is medical debt.
So there are a lot of challenges here, but Collins says that one of the hopes is that they might be able to find ways to make better products.
Can we work with industry to come up with products that work better? Savings products that don't have the hidden fees, that are flexible with low balances. Credit products that allow people to get some liquidity but don't get them in a trap.
Of course, it's complicated. There aren't a lot of incentives for the financial industry to develop more helpful products. Collins says that lack of profit opportunity is probably the biggest issue, but also that there are legal and regulatory hurdles, which is where public policy changes might be able to make a difference. Collins also says that since the start of the Great Recession, we're probably actually seeing fewer low-income people use mainstream banking products, a trend that's consistent across all income levels, actually.
So some are moving to online accounts, which are still banks, but they're sort of virtual banks, and some are moving to things like prepaid debit cards, where they no longer have a checking function at all. They just use a card. So everything is a card. Some of those cards have been very well received by low-income people, in part because they operate a lot like prepaid cell phone plans, which is what most low-income people have cell phones, and most of them have these prepaid cell phones where you load them at the store, then you run them down, and you load them again, and so it's a concept that makes a lot of sense.
As far as traditional banking goes, Collins says that while the economics, the terms and conditions and affordability of a product are a big deal, often it comes down to issues of accessibility.
You know, if I have to interact with a financial institution employee at a bank branch, that's a barrier because I have to get to the bank, maybe I have to ride public transportation, I have to bring kids along, and those things can make it more difficult. If I'm a low-income person and I have a disability, which is not, you know, oftentimes people have low incomes because they can't work, and one of the reasons they can't work is because of disabilities, those mobility issues can matter. So I think, you know, thinking through the issues of low-income people specifically, it's more complicated than just, you know, creating an account that has low fees. It's also thinking about how easy is it to operate, and does it not only have fees that are low, but is it transparent in terms of how it works, and is it easy to understand, and is it accessible, is it all those kinds of things I think are important to support people as they get more into mainstream financial institutions.
Professor Collins says that one of the big changes he sees coming is the advent of mobile banking, with people doing more and more of their financial transactions directly from their cell phone. This, of course, will add another layer of complication. Moving money around with the push of a button can be a problem for any of us. So he sees education as being crucial to making these new financial technologies a net gain for low-income people. Many thanks to J. Michael Collins for this interview. For more information on these issues, please see the links on the IRP Podcasts page or visit the Center for Financial Security online at cfs.wisc.edu. You've been listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research on Poverty.